Thank you so much to all of our presenters for your excellent and thorough presentations. I really like these top takeaways. I think they're very useful, so I hope that all of you joining on the webinar will also let us know if these top takeaways resonate with you, if you think that they will be useful for your work. All right, well, we have some time now for questions and answers. We've been collecting the questions that have come in along the way, and so we'll run through them, and we encourage you to continue to post questions in the chat box at any time, and we'll get through as many as we can over the next 30 minutes or so. All right. So first up, we'll kind of go back towards the beginning and ask a question to Claudia that came in from Indra Klein. While training can be designed and provided to women, how is the regional industry, namely men, being educated to be more accepting of women?
Yeah, just, you know, very quickly, taking together with the next slide that talks about this awareness. So this is really goes together. If you go back to the very original slide that I showed, we talk about reach, benefit, and empower. We do, I mean, as shown here, we do need to start with reaching women by informing them about the technology, informing them on how to get credit for the technology. But as soon as we move towards benefit and empowering, we actually have to make sure we talk to women and men. In fact, we always want to talk to both women and men. And if we actually want to move towards empowering women education, we have to make sure that we don't just talk to women in the households, but that we also talk to communities and to the communities. Because the long-term goal is to change gender norms. Understanding that women's decision over irrigation improves outcomes for everyone, not just for the women, but for the family, for family health, nutrition, and that's something that all men want. Each man, a family wants strong, healthy children that thrive, that have better opportunities for future income earning, and that's the same with the community. So I think the goal is that we don't stop at, you know, reaching women with some training activity, but that we move beyond, reach our communities and the child men, and that's really a main approach that's a very large difference.
And Indra also asked a follow-up question, which was, additionally, what steps are being taken to raise awareness with larger and that may rely on small stakeholders serving in the supply or smallholders serving supply?
Yes. Okay, maybe just to follow on, in fact, something we didn't talk about here in the PowerPoint is we implemented three large irrigation gender trainings that were focused at government agencies and implementers of irrigation projects in the three countries, Ghana, Ethiopia, and Tanzania. We had a very, you know, strong turnout and strong positive feedback. And there's a lot of materials that can be used that were developed for those trainings that can be used to reach out to, you know, additional agencies and implementers and even funders. So those materials are available for everyone, and we believe, you know, that we do need to have this training, provide this training, because a lot of the terminology sounds challenging to the traditional irrigation engineer who's implementing these projects. And I think that's what we need. We just need to increase capacity on the topic.
I think, you know, the focus of this research and this presentation is so much on the role of agribusiness, but it sounds like your question is, you know, curious about that. There does seem to be, you know, based on this research, a business case to be made for better and more inclusively disseminating irrigation technologies to both men and women. So we've, you know, seen cases of agribusiness companies working in Africa that are actively disseminating irrigation technology to save time and make their contract farmers more productive.
Great, thank you. I think we will we'll skip down to a question that came in during Elizabeth's presentation from Emily Miller, which was about the WEA scores. Are the WEA scores significantly different between those who use irrigation and those who don't? Is that something that you were able to observe?
So the WEA scores that I presented are the population-based measures, and my understanding is that can't look at statistical significance, the difference between those two measures, but I think there are other indicators that can do that with, like the 5DE would be one. So that is something that we're planning to do, but the table that I showed, we did not calculate the statistical significance of the difference between those scores. So, but I have talked to the people that created the WEA and that create the index. So we will look for ways to look at the difference between the individual WEA scores.
Great, thank you. And Nicole, a few questions came in for you from Indra Klein. And I think we'll go to the second one that's here on our list first. Has maintenance and management of equipment been a deterrent for women? If not, are there any data on whether there is a different pricing for repair and maintenance where women owners are concerned? So a little bit of a spotlight on equipment maintenance and how that could affect women.
Okay. I hope you can hear me because I am having some issues with connectivity.
Well, Nicole.
Okay, good. So in the various interviews we did, and we would always ask about constraints, there was never any mention by women about access to maintenance. And also there wasn't any mention of differential payments or prices for women and men. In the cost-benefit analysis, we know that men and women both pay the same for other inputs and for all of the services and for daily labor. So on the one hand, there isn't any reason to believe that it would be more expensive for women than men to, you know, that they would be charged more for that repair and maintenance. However, I think it's an interesting point because women often have less mobility, so they won't necessarily have a bicycle, or there may be some social norms around traveling alone. And in most cases, also, they would be taking equipment for maintenance in, you know, it could be even as far as the district capital. So we could see there some issues arise about women accessing repair and maintenance. Now, one of the potential solutions to that is a service provider model where you would actually have people who repair pumps but actually go to the field to repair them at the household or within the field itself. And we're seeing this pop up in other, you know, in places where they're providing, you know, service provision around, well, the pumps themselves for one, but also providing fuel or, you know, providing some types of other type, you know, other kinds of support, not necessarily repair and maintenance yet. But we could see the potential for a service provider model here that could be a really good opportunity and would help to address those issues around mobility. But I do take it as an important point, and I appreciate that you've raised that.
Great. Thank you, Nicole. And we'll go to another question for you, which was, given challenges regarding financing for women, do you have any thoughts on how local IFE and female-focused microfinance offices have been included in bringing about change?
Yeah, I think that there's an important thing to state here, which is that microfinance actually has very limited reach in rural areas. And, you know, one of the indicators that we looked at, or one of the variables we looked at, was proximity to any source of microfinance. And it's extremely low in all countries that we are working in. The other thing is that the women-focused microfinance institutions and the financial service providers often don't reach rural areas at all, and they cite the high transaction costs of operating in the rural areas and also high risks, and they prefer to lend to women for trading. So there is a lack of incentive there for some of the lending agencies to be involved in targeting women for irrigation technologies. Also, it's important that the range of rates, interest rates, and the terms and conditions provided by different microfinance institutions. Oftentimes, the microfinance institutions that are women-focused charge higher interest rates than cooperatives or informal sources. So, for example, in Ghana, the interest rate through a formal microfinance institution can be more than 50% a year. That's extremely high, and that's one of the reasons why the farmers prefer to go to a local cooperative or an informal source. So I think one of the key issues here is how do you create an incentive for a microfinance institution, though they're targeting women, to take on a higher risk and a high transaction cost to try to reach women in the rural areas. And we just don't really see much of a priority put on that by the microfinance institutions, even if they are women-focused.
Very interesting. Thank you. Certainly, if anyone on the webinar has experience with microfinance institutions and wants to chime in on what you've seen, that would be fantastic. And actually, it looks like Ruth has put in a comment in that regard. Yeah, it's very, very interesting. Thank you, Ruth, for sharing that perspective. All right. So now we'll jump down to a question that came in from Sudhir Yadav, which actually also came in during your presentation, Cole. Is there any behavior study to understand why men give priority to labor savings technologies while women look for multiple use technology? If women are seen as labor in the society, they might give priority to technologies to reduce their drudgery. Did you see any, you know, behavioral reasons for those differences in priority?
Well, and there's a way in which you can look at this and understand it as the same priority, because women are giving priority to multiple use technologies technologies because it saves them labor. Men are doing it because it saves labor for irrigation, but with multiple use options because it saves them labor not just for irrigation, but also for collecting domestic water, feeding livestock, household water need, basically. So there's a way in which it's both about reducing labor. It's just that women approach that reduction in a different way than men do. And there is a clear indication from the qualitative research that there is an interest in reducing drudgery. There was a very interesting case in Ghana where one community had a high level of out-migration of women, actually, to provide labor along the border with Burkina Faso in agriculture. And the men in that particular community really focused on ways that they could get technologies to reduce drudgery for both domestic and agricultural purposes, specifically for women, because they felt that it was important that women weren't really pushed to or forced to migrate to help the household income. So I think that there is some similarities there between both men and women about prioritizing labor saving. They just have a different entry point to do that. And I think that where the incentives are right, men do also prioritize reducing drudgery for women. It just depends on the local incentives in that particular case.
Excellent. Thank you. And as all of you can see, we just put up a slide on our screen with just some coming attractions in November. So we just wanted to make you aware of these. We'll keep going with questions. But for one point, we will be holding a continued discussion on AgriLink stemming from this webinar. So if you have further questions or just want to engage a little bit further, share some resources, we'll make sure you have that link to click over to our discussion. And we also have a few webinars coming up, a webinar next week on strengthening civil society's role in development, focusing on the Feed the Future Civil Society Handbook. And also we have a gender focus on AgriLink in November. So we're putting out a call for lots of resources, stories, blog posts, etc. If you have anything to share related to agricultural development and food security, you can post it directly on AgriLink or get in touch with us through email. And also, just to flag, next week there, or no, that is actually later this week, a special LandLinks webinar on the business case for land rights. We'll make sure you have that link in the chat box as well. Okay, so on to a few more questions. And let's see, we had one come in during Sophie's presentation, also from Indra Klein, who wanted to ask about movements among women to come together and begin change to renegotiate contracts that provide more benefit of technology, especially with the use of mobile tech and social media as a galvanizer.
Wow.
That's quite a question.
I think you should lead the way. So I don't know about the use of mobile technology and social media for this purpose. We do see, though, and often organically, women on their own initiative forming groups to either purchase or rent land along an irrigation canal in order to irrigate, or come together, as some examples Nicole mentioned, and collectively purchase irrigation pump. I think the point is that, you know, irrigation is quite transformative. It allows you to often produce a whole other harvest and, you know, assure your production despite increasingly variable rainfall. So, and often shift to higher value crops. So it's, you know, quite valuable to people, and women, you know, value this as well. So, you know, an example that I saw was in Ethiopia recently, a group of women had taken credit from the local like Women's Credit League and to rent land along an irrigation canal, which was just women run. They did this because they this was a way for them, a strategy for them to retain control over all of their earnings and production, despite the extra labor burden. So it would be great if there may be movements going on that I'm not aware of, and that'd be great if organizations could be supportive of women's groups that are taking the initiative on this going forward.
Great. Thank you, Sophie. Let's see. I think we'll jump to a question from Emily Miller that I thought was interesting. Are efforts to get women's input on priorities and design being sustained? I've only seen one project to date in this regard. So I'm assuming that she means, you know, getting input from the beneficiaries of a project about what that project is going to cover or what the priorities are. Have you seen that in this particular realm?
I mean, maybe to add there, I mean, to make sure that
these efforts are sustained, you know, you need a whole bunch of impact pathways. And one impact pathway that we have used in Ethiopia is to directly work with the Agricultural Transformation Agency, their gender expert, who is actually feeding in our results into policy documents, you know, to ensure that all efforts in Ethiopia on household irrigation, are beneficial to women and not just, you know, again, from reach to benefit to empower. So, you know, that's one impact pathway that you actually try to go up to the policy level at the, you know, with the national government and make sure that this is enshrined. But of course, as we know, you know, even enshrining enshrining gender in policy documents doesn't necessarily mean that we then actually reach women, empower them. So we have to work at various levels. And again, as we mentioned before, we have been doing these gender irrigation trainings with agencies and actually technical people who directly implement projects. Then we have to, you know, work again at the community level, talking with community leaders. But I think an issue that you also raised by posing that question is, to what extent are we able to go back like 5 years after, you know, one of these Feed the Future Innovation Lab projects has ended? You know, can we go back after 5 years and see, you know, what has been sustained? How have women been empowered? And that is, I guess, a challenge that all of us, both from the research side and from the implementation side, have, because we usually then have to move on to another project. So we have definitely seen on gender a lack of learning in terms of coming back a few years after an intervention has taken place. So that's something where more effort certainly is needed.
Thank you. And a question came in from Nama Raz Yassif, who was hoping that the team here could elaborate on women's preferences for types of technology, manual versus solar, et cetera, and also to please talk a little bit about scaling up of these technologies. And it sounds like Nicole is probably the best person to tackle that one. So Nicole?
The technology that was prioritized by women, but also by men, was solar. Perhaps for reasons, but that was the technology that they preferred. The women liked it because it doesn't require the physical labor that, for example, manual pumps require. Like pulley and rope and washer can be difficult to manage, particularly for kids who have to help with household and domestic water collection. But women also preferred the solar because of the fact that it was installed near the household. So women, for example, rope and washer was also installed near the household, and women liked the fact that they clean groundwater with rope and washer. But then if you figure in the labor aspect, they preferred solar over it. In terms of scaling, what we're doing in this project is looking at how the different approaches to irrigation and sort of the different technologies and crop combinations can be scaled in different locations. So mapping it based on the suitability of the technology and the crop. And we're also looking at the institutions and regulatory environment that either enhance or constrain scaling in the different countries where we're working. And one of the things that we're trying to focus on more in these last few months of the project is looking at the private sector role in scaling, because in most cases, the supply chain for the technologies themselves are underdeveloped in these countries. And developing those supply chains is, you know, it is a quite a complex process. So we're trying to engage more with the private sector and look at opportunities for, you know, service provision as well as supply chain development. So that is some of the ways that we are looking at the potential for scaling. But in order to look at the potential for scaling, we first had to do this research to understand what fit in what different context.
Yeah, I just want to emphasize again that the context is really important, that, you know, although we want to have these silver bullets to figure out how can we reach women and benefit women and empower women and, you know, what are women's preferences, again, I think we have to be careful because in every context, the constraints are going to be different. Women's roles in agriculture are going to be different. Their preferences are going to be different. So I think it's important to remember that we need to, you know, not only, you know, in our work, in the context that we're working, I think we're getting a better idea. But as these interventions are scaled and as other interventions are developed in other places, I think somebody was asking about Latin America. It's important to think about, you know, what are the specific preferences women have? What are the specific constraints they have? You know, how are gender roles in agriculture? And so I just, you know, want people not to leave the webinar thinking that, you know, we have all the answers and we can solve it today, but that this is a continual learning process as we improve, you know, people's access to water, small scale.
I think as we, one output that we're developing now, our series of questions that practitioners can use to ask the people they're trying to serve what it is that they want, what their household relationships and community relationships are like, in order to design projects that really meet their needs. I think we've learned a lot through this research about ways to ask this question and domains of sharing costs and benefits. Will be good for us. Stay tuned for that, basically.
Excellent. Well, I think that's a really strong note to wrap our webinar. We've gotten through a lot of our questions, and we are actually going to be continuing the questions over on AgriLink through an AgriLink session. We'll be sure to post that link in the chat box, but it's also up there on the left of your screen. Thank you all for filling out our polls today. They're very helpful to help us look forward to future webinars and figure out what we can do to make the webinar experience better for all of you. And if you are interested in joining the AgriLink mailing list, please do put your email in the box there on the center of your screen. The responses are hidden for that question, so it won't be broadcast to everyone, but we collect your email and make sure that you are aware of any future AgriLinks events and get on our mailing list. All right, I think we were able to tackle pretty much all of the questions, but again, click over to AgriLinks if you have more. And I would like to extend a sincere thank you to all of our presenters for joining us today. It was really a great presentation. And more importantly, I'd like to extend a thank you to all of you, our participants. Thank you for the great questions, for the engagement, and for continuing to attend AgriLinks webinars and making them worth it for us to help you as much as possible in your work. All right, so we're going to go ahead and sign off, but be on the lookout for the recording in case you'd like to share this with your colleagues, and we will be happy to engage with you further through AgriLink. All right, thank you all.
Thanks all.